This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today we are going to re-air a conversation with a favorite author in honor of her birthday. June 7th is the birthday of Louise Erdrich. Louise Erdrich is a National Book Award winner of more than two dozen novels, children's books, and poetry collections. She's won an O. Henry, a Saul Bellows, and an American Book Award. The Plague of Doves was nominated for a Pulitzer. The Roundhouse won the National Book Award. An enrolled member of the Turtle Mountain Band of Chippewa, much of her work explores spirituality, racism, and her own mixed Indigenous and European heritage. A Dartmouth grad, she was in the first class of women admitted to the Ivy League institution. Her novel, The Plague of Doves, set in the fictional town of Pluto, North Dakota, explores the aftermath of a racially motivated hanging of Indigenous men falsely accused of a brutal murder. Back in December, I spoke with Louise when it was part of the One Book, One Minnesota discussion. Louise, thank you so much for joining us today.
Oh, I'm just delighted.
With a book that came out more than a decade ago, even though you are the one who gave birth to the book, do you have to reread it for an event like this?
This one I do refer back to. Most books I don't reread, but this one has a kind of life of its own. The stories in it are haunting to me, so I do reread it every so often. I don't really have to refer back.
What haunts you about this book?
Several of the characters come back to me. You know, I so enjoyed writing the character Shaman Gua. I loved writing the story about how this violin came to be. And it really is a tribute to the people around the Turtle Mountains and up into Canada, Ojibwe, Cree, and Métis people who have brought the art form of violin playing or fiddling to an incredible level, who have an extraordinary history with this instrument. So I wanted to write something about it that was maybe beyond what we think of as reality, but incorporated the supernatural. So that was a story that literally was about a haunting, a violin that returned continually to its chosen person.
The violin from The Plague of Doves, it is a type of haunting, and it has this ethereal beauty and otherworldly power to it. And it reminds me a bit of the drum in The Painted Drum. You seem to have this affinity for the role of a non-human character.
Well, thank you. I don't know that I've ever thought of it that way, but I do think of some pieces of the made world as incorporating a kind of aliveness that other things don't have, you know, something that you can play. A musical instrument, for instance, has a voice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And the violin always has its own particular voice. And I love that about instruments, that they develop their voices with use, that certain instruments respond more to certain musicians and vice versa. Not only that, but a drum itself is really considered to have a living spirit. And that's why I wrote The Painted Drum the way I did.
As you're putting yourself in the perspective of trying to tell the story through a violin or through these drums, these instruments that are very much associated oftentimes with sacred tradition, how do you try to put yourself in that point of view?
I don't think I could really do it if I thought about it a lot, you know, if I considered how am I going to do this.
Okay.
I sometimes feel daunted, but I don't think, how will I do this? I trust that if this is the right thing for me to be writing, that the voice will come and I will be perhaps made secondary to the writing itself and to the voice.
It sounds like it comes from a place of knowing or feeling more so than a place of intellect. Is that fair to say?
It's hard to divorce those two. I feel like we're all one, you know. We don't know what part of the mind or the body is influencing what. I would say it's maybe what we call intuition, which really does encompass what you cerebrally pick up in the world and also what you respond to in almost a supersensory way. And also what your awareness can encompass. And that can be a very ordinary thing. I mean, we're always taking in information, right?
Mm-hmm.
Sometimes we take in more information than we know we're taking in. I think that's why we dream. I mean, I think we have to process so much of the information that comes at us, and it comes out in this very spectacular way sometimes in our dreams.
In an addendum from the book, I believe it's from the last report on the miracles at Little No Horse, you write that you sometimes don't remember having written what you have written. Is this like a trance or a fugue state? Or what do you remember from the state of mind when you are producing?
Well, when I say that, I'm saying that I don't remember it many years later.
Oh.
Not that I don't remember it in the, you know, the days and months and years immediately after writing it, but I don't tend to reread my books very often. So sometimes I will come across something that I've written and it really surprises me. I've been trying to sort through a lot of things I wrote back in, you know, in the 90s and in the late 80s, and I didn't publish, and I think I really don't remember what I'm reading right now. So this is something about being in your 60s, that you have 40 years of writing behind you, and how can you remember everything? How could I remember everything?
I don't remember what I had for breakfast, so.
Yeah, I know, especially these days. I mean, we have a very strange thing happening to our sense of time and our memories and our dreams as well. I was talking to my daughters because we all had very vivid dreams that occurred on the same night.
Oh,
and
wow.
We're exchanging, and we all realized that, you know, a friend of ours had come down with COVID, and they were all COVID anxiety dreams. And they were just played out in different ways in our dream state. And I think that's happening to a lot of people in our isolation and our concern, especially for other people. We dream in ways that are surprising, and sometimes we mesh with other people's dreams, because we're often in the same sort of anxiety state as other people.
Or that intuition state you mentioned earlier.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
When you say that you have been surprised by things that you have written a long time ago, do you ever cringe at what you wrote and think, oh, why did I think that was good? Or are you surprised, like, why didn't I ever publish this? This is golden.
That's a great question. And yes, I cringe. I always read something over and think, oh no, why didn't I just, my worst mistake is overwriting. I write down one sentence that is perfectly good at describing something, but then I just have to ice the cake, you know? And maybe the icing is just way too much. So I tend to look back, and it's the things that I tried too hard to overwrite that make me cringe now.
So the book's benefit, would you say, from an editor? Because I would imagine it's very hard to give up something that you spent this much time and energy calling into being.
I have a wonderful editor, but she doesn't really line edit so much as respond to larger inconsistencies in the book. I've always listened to criticism. If there's any advice that I give the writers, it's set your ego aside and listen to criticism. You don't have to take it, but you really have to open yourself and listen and don't, immediately defend your work, because if someone's giving you honest criticism, then that's a gift. And to immediately go, oh, no, but I was trying to say this, is to really thrust away that gift. And the gift is that somebody actually has taken the time to read your work and respond to it. So I really treasure the fact that I have a good editor. And I really treasure her responses. And I also, my daughters read my books, my sisters, I really have people who care about the work who will give me some first reads on the books. And that's invaluable.
Well, you have two sisters who are accomplished writers themselves.
Oh, yes.
You're almost the football version. You're the writing version of the Manning brothers.
Well, I sort of preferred to reference Bronte sisters or something,
So who's Charlotte?
And then, of course, I have my youngest sister, Angela, who's a doctor, is also extraordinarily talented. She's an artist. Her artwork is often really inspiring.
And you've brought in your daughter, I believe, on at least one novel for some of the artwork as well. Am I remembering this correctly? She did the book cover for La Rose?
She's done the cover for almost all of the books now.
Wow.
So they were republished with her cover. So almost all of them. And now that's actually in my contract. And my publishing company is delighted with this because she's really good at this.
Yeah, well, it is a case of you want to judge a book by its cover, because I think in a lot of cases it adds to the book to be able, especially when you've finished a novel, to go back and read something that you think, oh, I didn't really pick up on that right away.
I feel that way too. I feel that if you have a beautiful cover, you can go out and you have to represent your book at some point and go out and talk to people about it. And I've always been concerned about my covers because it's so easy, especially in the beginning. I mean, back in the 80s, there were so many stereotypical ideas about what made, if I was writing about Native American people in the novel, then it was that I would have had to really fight for a cover that was not stereotypical. But as time has gone on, I'm really lucky to have found out this wonderful collaboration with my daughter is really central. Her cover for the Roundhouse, especially the paperback Roundhouse, which is this woman who is kind of shadowy beneath this flowing, almost like a river of red, was astounding. I mean, it really informed the book for me. I think my mother got tears in her eyes because it was so resonant. It's an extraordinary cover.
And you have a daughter who also is fluent in, am I pronouncing this correctly, Ojibwemowin?
Ojibwemowin.
Ojibwemowin. Thank you.
Yes, that's my daughter, Neka Nime Damokwe. That's her name in Ojibwe. And she's a wonderful teacher. I just tuned in to her kindergarten class online, of course. It's all immersion. It's all in Ojibwe.
And you are able to include some of your ancestral language in many of your novels. Do you ever write first in Ojibwemowin?
I wish I could, but I don't have that level of language. Ojibwemowin is maybe the most difficult language. For a while, it was in the Ripley's whatever.
Right, the hardest grammar.
The hardest language to learn. It's very difficult. So I have to keep renewing my commitment to it. And sometimes I go backwards and sometimes I go forwards, you know.
In many of your novels, you explore your ancestry, and this would be primarily Ojibwe and German, and to a lesser extent, Métis. And if I could bring it back to the musical instruments for a moment, the drums, of course, feature heavily in many indigenous cultures, and the violin or fiddle, very much associated with the Métis culture. Do you want to explore the German culture, perhaps with an accordion?
Oh, well, I just don't have the basis to do that, but the book The Master Butcher's Singing Club was about German choral groups that were formed within the various guilds in Germany, and my grandfather belonged to the Metzgermeister's Guild in Germany. He came here after World War I, and he went back to Germany after World War II, and the remnants of his singing club apparently met him when he got there and sang to him.
Wow. The combination of coming from a background that didn't have a written history for a long time, and then, of course, a culture, a dominating culture that was hugely destructive to the land and to the people. Many of the cultural and linguistic and religious traditions were broken. In terms of knowing the religious and spiritual and even sort of, because your books are very, very funny, and I have heard that over and over, that in particular the Ojibwe are known for being very humorous storytellers. And so I'm wondering, is there a line that you had been able to rely on for learning these cultural traditions, given all that had been happening in an attempt to erase that culture?
Well, I would just say that living in a mixture of cultures, and I think almost every Native person really has to make a decision to actively seek out teachers and people who can really inform you about your own traditions, and whether they're relatives or people you meet or people you go to ask for help, or, you know, teachers in school systems. There's always a way to find people who can tell you. And not only that, but I mean, if I'm going to write about anything, I have to do some kind of deep dive into research. And so I am continually reading and absorbing facts and histories and keeping in touch with what's happening now. Right now, I'm really absorbed in the history and the present trajectory that this pipeline, that's the Tar Sands Line 3, mm-hmm. which is crossing over White Earth and Red Lake, and Leaf Lake, crossing over all these treaty lines and endangering this homeland. Not only that, but our state, really. I'm really interested in that. So I'm really trying to grasp what this means, not only for Indigenous people, but for people who are going to have to survive now and in the future. It's pretty tragic what's happening, and I think that one day it will be something that is seen as one of the great mistakes that has been made in terms of turning around this great juggernaut of a ship that we've launched, which is called climate change and climate chaos. It's very hard to turn around, and building a vast new tar sands pipeline is a terrible idea. So, and this is a very Anishinaabe or Ojibwe of great concern, because we're first impacted by these pipelines and also by COVID up there. So I'm interested in what's happening now, what's happening historically. You know, this goes back way back to the Old Crossing Treaty. Our history of exploitation and extraction and the misuse of our resources, the destruction of the forest, you know, everything that's happened. I mean, a lot of that is in the books, and it continues on into the present. So the present really is the past. We're seeing that working out of history in what's happening now.
Are you seeing anything happening now that is giving you hope for the future? And this is just a tiny example, but on the 2020 NPR Concierge Top Books of the Year, there is a book called We Are Water Protectors, and it's not about the tar sands, mm-hmm. but it is about Dakota Access, mm-hmm. a pipeline, and that is getting national attention. And it's written specifically as a children's book, something that is meant to teach grassroots from the very tender age of childhood and on up. Are you seeing anything that gives you hope?
Oh, yes. I would never not have hope about this. And I really have so much confidence, and I'm excited about the movement toward a just climate future for people. We have to have it. We don't really have a choice. I mean, it's really get in there and do this, or we will not survive as a species. I mean, this really is a fact. It's nothing to be debated, and it's not about politics one bit. It's about we're at the edge of the cliff, and as the UN has talked about it, is our world being basically over the cliff. So I don't know if one book will do it, but many, many books and many, many people's minds being affected from an early age really may do it. I mean, we have a whole different understanding of what climate change means. We're way behind. We're way behind where we should be. We've had almost 40 years now to really do something about this, but we've had enormous conflict with fossil fuel corporations, and we all try very hard, I think, to do our best to do personal recycle, you know, and use less. And I think people really want to be conservative in their own use of resources, but we won't get anywhere until we really affect this on a global, multinational, corporate level. And that means, you know, banks and churches. This is a huge movement. It has really gained so much strength.
You said in that answer, a just world. And The Plague of Doves, of course, is not a novel about climate change, but it does explore that concept of justice. You could say that the novel is pretty haunted by an act of a heinous, racist injustice. What draws you to the theme of justice?
You just ask such good questions. What actually is it? I think having experienced what it's like to be on the other side and knowing how brutal it is to be simply disregarded in the world and to be exploited and disregarded. So these are things that I may not have felt at the level that other people have felt, but I have felt them. They resonate for me. I have to write about them. I can't turn away. I don't really have a choice. You know, that's not in me to have a choice. I really don't know much about anything else. I mean, I don't know that world in which there is no thought of injustice or caring for people. A lot of that's because of my parents as well. They're school teachers. They're living in North Dakota. And they always cared about other people. And they always did their best for other people. They shared. They volunteered. They just taught by example in their family as well as in classrooms.
You're listening to a conversation with Louise Erdrich, the National Book Award-winning author. This conversation first aired in December. Coming up in the second half of today's show, we talk about the blending of her Anishinaabe and a Christian upbringings. But now it's time for the news.
For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster. The 2021 legislature set aside $70 million from federal COVID-19 relief money for career and technical education centers, and the director of the state's CTE office, Wade Sick, says he expects there to be a lot of demand for that money.
I really have zero concerns that we won't be able to use the funding. You know, now we're getting it to the point of are we going to run out of dollars before all the needs are met.
Sick says the demand for CTE programs is coming from business and industry who needs the workforce. He says high schools have to offer CTE programs either online or through a brick and mortar facility. But Sick says the issue is what courses are being provided.
You know, if you go to a typical small town high school, you're going to see an agricultural education program. You'll maybe see a family and consumer science program, maybe a business program. Those are kind of the three traditional ones we see, and they are great programs. But if you have a student that has an interest in information technology, if you have a student that's interested in specifically welding, there's welding in ag education, but it's not as in depth as an actual welding program.
Sick says the CTE board is now in the process of determining what will be in the grant applications for that $70 million, and it will require a dollar-for-dollar match. Thursday, an application window opens for the Events and Support Services Grants Program. Those grants are designed to assist event centers in supporting businesses still experiencing negative impact from the COVID-19 pandemic. They're to be used to make up for lost revenue. Sarah Adi Coleman is with the State Department of Commerce.
So that would include, you know, not only event venues like theaters and you know, places that host, you know, large catering events or business events, but also it would include festivals. And then the businesses that support those. So you think about the promoters who promote the concerts, or the decorators or photographers or caterers that help produce those events that just didn't have any business because the events weren't taking place.
Businesses must prove at least a 50% revenue loss from 2019 to 2020. The applicants may be awarded up to $100,000 per location. Applications will be accepted starting at 10 a.m. on Thursday. And portions of south central and eastern North Dakota may see a chance of severe weather tonight, this evening and overnight. National Weather Service forecaster Alex Edwards says it will likely happen south and east of Bismarck, moving into the Jamestown area. As for the threats,
we could see a 2-inch diameter hail, maybe a little greater. Damaging wind is certainly possible. There is a tornado threat with this, although the hail and wind is more likely, but can't be ruled out.
Edwards says more severe weather is possible in North Dakota Tuesday and Thursday. For Prairie Public, I'm Danielle Webster.
Support for Prairie Public is provided by AARP North Dakota. Looking for ways to safely stay active, healthy, and informed without leaving home? AARP North Dakota has lots of online offerings. Learn more about the ways you can stay connected to your community at aarp.org/ndevents.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and today, June 7th, is the birthday of author Louise Erdrich, and we are re-airing a conversation that I had with the National Book Award-winning author back in December. We, at that time, were discussing her novel, The Plague of Doves, which was a finalist for a Pulitzer. She was discussing that book in advance of a One Book, One Minnesota event. Much of her work explores her Indigenous and European ancestry, and religion is no exception.
Throughout many of your novels, the religious and spiritual traditions of both from an Anishinaabe perspective and from a Christian perspective, they appear in tandem in your books. What draws you to each of those? They're not that different in a lot of ways.
Well, I was raised with a very strong Catholic background. My mother is a strong practicing Catholic, but she's also a very strong Anishinaabe Ojibwe woman. You know, she's very alive to her traditions, and she's an artist. I really had to take apart this world of spirituality. I think it's easy to tell that I was captivated by Catholicism, I knew long parts of the Latin Mass. You know, I can still recite prayers in Latin, and I think there was opulence to religious tradition that resonated for me and in all through life. And of course, I was taught by Franciscan sisters, so you know, that was very much part of my life. But I didn't ever feel that it had a lot to do with God. I felt it was more like a big art. I mean, I guess I wouldn't have been able to put it into words as a kid, but you know, it was like a big theatrical performance, you know, Catholicism. And that's, I think, why it really has this hold on people, because of the performative aspect of it as a religion. I mean, it's high style, right? When you see those red shoes that the Pope wears, everything like that. I mean, so I really was drawn there by gravity. But my grandfather practiced both religions. He was in the Mide. He was a traditional Ojibwe religion, and he was also a Catholic. So he saw no reason to think that God was specific to one or another, and I don't either. I think that there is a kind of category that really fits a description of God. There is this huge unknown spirit who lives and has a kind of justice about it that says very simply, if you use me up, you die. That's what I see.
Wow.
As the natural justice. I will support you and love you and take care of you as long as you support and love and take care of me. That's what the justice of the natural world is to me. And I will also give you a vast experience of beauty. I will give you art that cannot be reproduced except a concept of your own soul. That's what the natural world means to me. I will give you the heavens, which you cannot comprehend. I will give you the smallest insect, which you could never create on your own. You know, I will give you the experience of all these things. You can't own me. I will give you your life and your experience. Unless you use me up. You know, unless you use me up, unless you throw all your carbon in the air, unless you totally deplete me, I will take care of you. But don't mess me up. Don't mess me up. That's all that's asked. And so to me, you know, churches and cathedrals and whatever forms we put upon this vastness of spirit, right? The beautiful pieces of art, whatever rules we lay down, whatever rules religions lay down, have nothing really to do with communion, with this power, this incomprehensible power that we call God. And God doesn't care. I mean, we can feel like God cares about us because we love, we want to exchange love with a loving creator. I think we have a loving creator. We can see it in every plant that's around us, right? But this may not be personal. You know, I know a lot of people who pray for things, and they don't happen. And a lot of people, and you know, it really takes an exchange. I think love is an exchange, and you know, we have to be willing to exchange here. It's more than I can really express, but you know, that's my try.
That grandfather you mentioned, was that Patrick, the former tribal chair, Patrick Jordan?
Oh yes, Patrick.
I think he must have had an incredible influence on you. Of course, The Night Watchman, your latest novel, is about him. But I'm wondering, just to keep this back with the plague of doves, do we see some of Patrick in the character Musham?
Oh, no. Yes and no. I mean, Musham seemed to be his own his own person, and which is far more profane and far more, he's in a different category.
Okay. All right. Well, I hope I didn't insult your grandfather with that.
Not at all. Mushim and Nana Push are some of my favorite characters.
Nana Push is just behind the painted drum itself. I think Nana Push is my favorite. But going back to the Christian symbolism that shows up specifically in this book, doves are, of course, they feature heavily in the thought of peace. And then you give a title like The Plague of Doves, and they are wreaking havoc and destroying crops. Why did you choose that bird?
A lot of Plague of Doves is based on historical facts, sort of here and there. And one account that I read talked about exactly what happens in the first chapter, which is instead of a plague of locusts, they used to call pigeons doves, and we had a plague of doves come down. Our crops were devoured. This is before the extinction of the passenger pigeons. They opened the sky and covered the fields and devoured everything. It's hard to imagine now, but yes, they did. I was fascinated because, in truth, a priest tried to pray away the doves with the congregation, took his people from his parish, and they moved into the fields praying desperately that the doves would leave. So that started the book for me. I couldn't stop thinking about it.
When you are writing for adults versus writing for children, a comparison between something like The Roundhouse, which has a horrendous rape in it, and then you have this charming book, The Range Eternal, and it's about the love that a stove can bring into a home when that stove is reflective of the love of your people. What is the difference for you in the writing process of when you're writing for adults and writing for children?
I write for children the way I would like the world to be. The world is also full of goodness and kindness and beauty. These things are very important to talk about as well. I think that in each book is... as terrifying and horrifying as some of the things that happen are, I'm very interested in depicting how people handle the bad things that happen and how they come to terms with and how they try to make their own justice if they can't retrieve some form of justice from our institutions. But children's books are, for me, like writing poems. They come out as, I start writing them and they just flow out. So I don't really have an answer that encompasses, some sort of volition on my part. It's more a sense of, I want to write this beautiful story, which really speaks to my own childhood. My parents really gave me a huge gift in that they gave me a peaceful, funny childhood with lots of brothers and sisters and people to play with and a huge garden, and my mother made my clothes. It was, I really had a childhood. There's a lot of freedom that I like writing about. I like writing about that childhood, and it's an ideal childhood, really. But it's good to have those ideals. It's good to have those things to look at when you're a child.
You just mentioned that theme of justice again, and in The Plague of Doves, that violin becomes a key element of the justice finally served in the book. Did you know that was going to happen when you first started writing the book? Like, was that the plan all along?
No, indeed I didn't. Sometimes I know how the book will end and what will bring it together, but with The Plague of Doves, it seems that I was writing really in the dark, and I was going story by story and piece by piece, and it took this enormous juggling act, and I really almost broke my brain on putting that book together, because I remember thinking, I know this is together. I know it does. And I put everything. My daughter laughs because I go, oh, I'm crawling around on the floor again. And that means I'm trying to figure out what this book is. Mm. I put everything I'd written on the floor. And then I clipped pages together that were reflective and had some sort of definition of voice that compelled me to go onward with it. I mean, it was just an endless slog. That was a very hard book to write, and it was even harder to copy edit. I remember I really thought my mind would disintegrate under the level of copywriting questions that I was answering.
How is your bookstore doing during a pandemic? Because, of course, you operate Birchbark Books.
I'm happy to say that it's doing well. I can't say enough for people who support small bookstores, small independent bookstores in this time. It means everything to us that people have remembered us and continued to order books and to go on. We also have a business that is incorporated into our webpage in which we sell jewelry. So I always wanted to sell beautiful things that Native people make. I am very grateful to be able to say that we're doing all right.
Have there been any benefits of a pandemic for being a writer?
You know, you'd think so, wouldn't you? We're all kind of isolated and more time, supposedly.
Yeah.
I would say no. No. I tend to spend my days just sort of like thinking, what should I be doing now? No, I can't think of anything. Hmm. My main thing that's been a benefit is growing closer. I'm really lucky because my daughters are close. And so growing closer to my daughters and really tending more to my grandchildren, that's been incredible. My sisters, but that really isn't made up for by the fact that I can't be with my parents. Mm. No, I plan to spend this year in the Red River Valley. That was my plan. I had a book I was working on, which was about sugar beets, the life that I lived that was dominated by the sugar beet. And I wanted to write about it, but I couldn't. I couldn't go and live with my parents. And I was going to divide my time, but, you know, I really miss them. And I think everyone who's cut off from their parents or their grandparents or great-grandparents feels the same way. I was able to go, and we'd sit outside and everything. So that was, you know, through the summer, it's not like, I mean, they live at home, so my brother and sister in the town they live in are just heroic in caring for them. But we were able to go and visit and talk and be part of each other's, one another's lives throughout that time. So I'm very grateful for that. And also I get to go and I have places to stay in the area where, but I can't go around and visit people and interview people, you know, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
I do that right now.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, you said you can't be living with your parents and dedicating yourself fully to the book about sugar beets, but are you dedicating some of your time? Will we be lucky enough to read this book soon?
Oh, sure. I'm always working on a book. I'm writing one that is about a haunted bookstore. So I'm writing on ghosts, which is really weirdly appropriate. And I feel like we're all kind of haunted right now. So in a way, yes. And also, I'm writing about ghost stories. I'm collecting ghost stories and that kind of thing. And it was on a book tour when the pandemic really became apparent in the United States. I would always ask, how many people believe in ghosts? And only a few hands would go up in the audience. But then I would ask, how many people have experienced or have know people who have seen ghosts or have heard ghosts or whatever. I mean, almost every hand went up. So it was really interesting to me that we have this non-believer, but yeah, I think I've experienced it. I found it so interesting. Part of what happened during this time, though, is that I decided I wanted to entertain people because we need a lot of entertainment. So that's partly what the book is about. It's called The Sentence, and it's primarily written for entertainment.
Well, that sounds like it will be another great book to read. Louise Miguich, thank you so much for your time today. This has been an absolute honor.
I have really tremendously enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for reading so closely in the book and for doing this interview.
That was author Louise Erdrich, author of more than 24 novels, children's books, and poetry collections. For her work, she's won an O. Henry, a Saul Bellows, and an American Book Award. The Roundhouse won the National Book Award. That conversation first aired in December 2020.
We'd like to thank the North Dakota Council on the Arts for supporting arts programming along with our members and other sources here on Prairie Public.
Psychologist Bruce Hood has amassed dozens of posters from his favorite horror movies.
And I don't have a house that big I could even display them, but I kept buying things. It was more the chase of getting it, and that's what really drove me on. And this has been borne out by the science.
The emotional ties that bind us to our stuff. This week on Hidden Brain from NPR.
Tonight at 8 Central, 7 Mountain, here on Prairie Public.
This is Main Street on Prairie Public. I'm Ashley Thornburg, and this hot turn of the weather has a lot of people heading towards the nearest body of water. So why not take up some good fishing? In this week's Natural North Dakota essay, biologist Chuck Lura talks about walleye.
I recently saw a few photographs of some impressive walleye taken from the Missouri River this spring in the vicinity of Bismarck. Walleyes are undoubtedly the most popular fish in North Dakota in terms of angling interest and table fare. It might surprise some of you, but the walleye is closely related to the perch. They're in the same order and family. Fish in their order may be characterized by having a dorsal fin, that's the fin on the back of the fish, that's divided into two segments, or with a narrow connection in some species. The front segment consists of spiny rays, while the rear segments have soft rays. The family includes walleye, sauger, perch, and darters. It also includes the European zander. Some of you may remember that there was considerable interest in zander as a game fish in North Dakota back in the 1980s. As with plants, the common names of fish can sometimes be confusing, and occasionally the walleye is an example of that. Most of us know this fish as a walleye, but it's also known as a yellow pickerel, or just pickerel north of the border, and it's occasionally referred to as a walleye pike. One may infer from that the walleye is a close relative of the northern pike, which it's not. Northern pike, or simply northern or jack north of the border, is in a different order than the walleye. Members of this order, which includes the northern pike and muskie, are known for having sharp teeth and a cigar-shaped body which is good for swimming in short, fast bursts straight ahead. They're fast and fierce predators. In addition, they have their dorsal fin and anal fin set back near the forked tail. So if you hear or see reference to a walleye pike, remember that the walleye is not a close relative of the northern pike. And it's interesting to note that Garrison, North Dakota is the walleye capital of the world, and the Garrison Dam National Fish Hatchery is the largest walleye hatchery in the world. I'm Chuck Lura.
Natural North Dakota is supported in part by the NDSU Central Grasslands Research Extension Center. Subscribe to the podcast or find past episodes at prairiepublic.org.
This is Dakota Datebook for June 7th. One fact we can probably all agree upon is that North Dakota enjoys a historical and essential partnership with agriculture. A small but vibrant example is the reception received by the North Dakota Agricultural College's traveling farm train in June of 1910. It was called the Better Farming Train, and when it pulled in to the Davenport, North Dakota Railroad Station, it was met by throngs of interested citizens. The Forum newspaper wrote that the day's crowd was large by 8 a.m., and some 600 or 700 people visited over the course of the day, almost everyone a person living on a farm. The coaches of the farm train were designed to display, instruct, and feature the latest scientific agricultural exhibits, providing tips for the onlookers. After the initial hour of the gathering, the attendees adjourned to a hall where they met a Mr. Willard, who represented the Northern Pacific Railroad. The railroad partnered with NDAC by supplying the train. The Agricultural College afforded two of its star professors to teach, advise, and mingle with the citizens. Professor Lawrence Waldron offered ag advice as well as his expertise on the type of trees needed on North Dakota prairies. Professor John Shepherd discussed clover and corn production. Both professors were early hires at the NDAC and remain honored with buildings named for them, Shepherd Arena and Waldron Hall. Farmers' institutes provided outreach to rural families in a number of states through their agricultural colleges, and NDAC was one of those participants. With the start of the Extension Division in 1914 and in partnership with the state's Agricultural Experiment Station, the NDAC staff helped run and teach the popular institutes. The cooperation between the railroad and the campus led to many successful collaborations that allowed the campus to reach one of its goals, to make the state its campus. Today's Dakota Datebook was written by Steve Stark. I'm Merrill Pepcorn.
Dakota Datebook is produced in cooperation with the State Historical Society of North Dakota, with funding from Humanities North Dakota.
New social media rules in India give the government more power to regulate content on platforms like Twitter. But Twitter hasn't made the changes they've asked for.
You are a giant earning billions of dollars globally. You can't find a technological solution?
A standoff over censorship and free speech in one of technology's biggest markets. On the next morning edition from NPR News.
Starting at 4 a.m. Central, right here on Prairie Public.
That's it for this Monday edition of Main Street. Coming up tomorrow on the show, there's a new show on Fox called Crime Scene Kitchen, where teams have to go into a kitchen, look at the clues about what was made, figure out what was made, and then make it themselves, all within 2 hours. And there are two North Dakota natives on the show. We are going to visit with Thomas McCurdy and his mom, Kathy Jacobson, of Devil's Lake. That's coming up tomorrow on Main Street. Until then, enjoy the rest of your day.